The meth epidemic in America's heartland.
Really, this whole meth business is, to me, more of an indication that the bases of economy have simply vanished in most of the rural United States.
That's Nick Redding. We talked to him about how methamphetamine is eating away at rural America. His book is Methland. And the naturalist Henry David Thoreau burns down a forest.
He begins by talking about how he felt shameful and guilty for having brought this destruction upon the natural world. And then he stops and says, but the fire was a glorious spectacle, and he was the only one there to enjoy it.
That's John Pitkin talking about Henry David Thoreau. His debut novel, Woodsburner, takes that fire as a starting point to examine the destruction human passions can cause. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Journalist Nick Redding grew up in the American heartland, then a place of small farms and good jobs in stable communities. In 2005, he went back to the heartland, to the town of Olwine, Iowa, a place that used to be a lot like Redding's own hometown. Now it's a community torn apart by the meth epidemic, with families destroyed, kids abused and neglected, broken lives, and a poisoned environment. An example of individual failings? Not so fast, Redding says. Olwine's tweakers and meth sellers are former hard-working Americans who were set adrift by a heartless corporate economy. It foreclosed on their farms, sent jobs abroad, and slashed wages by two-thirds for the jobs that were left. Redding's book is Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. Well, Nick Redding, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I found Methland a wonderful and very disturbing book. Disturbing, of course, because of its subject matter, but wonderful in the way it really situated a drug epidemic that we've heard an awful lot about in the last few years within its larger context, which I really don't think has happened very much.
I hope it seems new, because, you know, there certainly was so much coverage of the whole meth thing for a while that I wanted to try and do something a little different with it.
Yes. Now, you know, in 2006, I had the honor of being awarded second place in getting the Nancy Dickerson Whitehead Award for reporting on substance abuse issues. And first place that year went to Frontline for its documentary, The Meth Epidemic.
Okay.
Which I actually saw today for the first time. The Frontline on meth really did not mention the larger context. You went to a small town, Olwine, in Iowa. And before we kind of get into what happened to the town, I'd like you to describe a little bit about what it looked like. What kind of a place was it when you came and when you first started reporting on it?
Well, Olwine is in northeast Iowa, and it's a town of about 6,700 people. And it's kind of the biggest town around, meaning, you know, it's probably the biggest thing for 40 miles in any direction anyway. And when I first got there in 2005, I don't think probably looked like most people would expect a small Midwestern town to look. All of the sort of skeletal aspects were there, the churches and the buildings and the feed store, you know, and the old farmhouses, but a lot of the town, at least on Main Street, was vacant. Much of the business had left, and it was just sort of in general disrepair.
And why was that?
Well, the three pillars upon which the economy of the town had rested for over 100 years, the railroad, the meatpacking plant, and basically high corn prices, a good farming economy, all of that just went away over the course of the last 20 years, which is a very short time for all of the bases of a place's economy to vanish.
You stay in Methland, Nick Redding. You say that the story of methamphetamine is about the death of a way of life, which I think you've just described. You talk about an increasing divide between the farmer and the tweaker.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, I think one of the principal things that I mean by, the principal thing that I mean is that a drug epidemic, to me, particularly this one, to say it's not about the drug is a little bit of an overstatement, but really this whole meth business is, to me, more of an indication that the bases of economy have simply vanished in most of the rural United States, and I would really say most of the middle of the United States. So that, to me, is really the story, and this meth stuff just sort of made that clear.
And yet, you also say that it's not just any drug that really could have done what meth has done. You say that meth is ideally suited to middle America. So on the one hand, you're saying that here, you know, people really had their lives, their world, their whole economy just vanish under their feet. But why was meth the drug that came in?
Well, you know, I think if you look at meth as a symptom of collapse, then certainly the drug's personality, I think, is particularly well suited to middle America and to small town America. In a number of ways, one of the principal reasons is that historically meth is not a recreational drug; it's more of a vocational drug, and for. 60 or 70 years, working class people have used methamphetamine to help them work harder, essentially, because you don't have to eat or sleep. You can just simply work more and longer. I think that meth's one of the other unique things about it is it's very cheap. So there's a reason that a lot of people in Old Wine don't do cocaine, because cocaine is expensive. And I think the final piece of it is that meth is the only drug that I know of that people can make themselves out of, you know, readily and easily available materials. And so in that way, I think it's perfectly suited to, if you're poor and you want to do it. It's like moonshine, basically. I mean, you can make your own, and it's cheap.
I guess maybe this is really the time to ask, what does meth do? What are the effects of meth, at least in the sense of at least those that are the ones that attract people to the drug?
Right. Physically, the effect of meth is to keep you very high and euphoric for a long time. And what I mean by that is that you don't have to do another line every 20 minutes like with coke, because if you do a line of meth, you're high for 12 hours. There's a lot of bang for your buck there. One thing about meth that is unique biochemically is that in addition to making your brain cells secrete neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine, methamphetamine actually blocks the ability of your brain cells to reabsorb those neurotransmitters. So essentially, they make you feel good for a much longer period than nicotine or alcohol or heroin. And so that's another, I think, aspect of what is so unique about meth. And that's also part of why it has long been a working person's drug, because, you know, if you're doing very difficult physical labor, and you can remove the desire or the need to eat and to sleep and to drink water, and you can feel really good while you're doing something that is physically taxing and very tiring, then, you know, in a lot of ways that makes for a very handy drug.
In fact, you talk about, you know, the loss of good jobs in the sense that people went from earning, you know, let's just take, for example, the meatpacking industry. Owine is was a railroad and meatpacking town. You know, people used to make good union factory wages, maybe $18, $19 an hour. And then the unions went away. They were driven away.
Right.
And people's wages dropped down to what was that?
How much? $6.20.
$6.20. And so this meant that people had to work an awful lot more. Isn't
yeah.
It?
Yeah. To make a third the money, you know, or so wages dropped by two thirds essentially overnight. And you know, one of the things that I'm not sure people hear about very often is that when this was happening, for instance, in the meatpacking plant in Owine, a town like Owine was handicapped severely by the farm crisis. A lot of people had to foreclose on their land, so remaining jobs were all the more precious. And so meatpacking companies at the time, which today have become the sort of titans of the food industry, not just meatpacking, but every conceivable aspect of the production, distribution, and retail selling of food in this country and in the world, in fact. At the time, those companies were in their sort of embryonic phase, and meatpacking was their way into the market. And so a company like IBP, Iowa Beef Packers, would hold a town hall meeting in a town like Owine, and they would essentially say, we're going to close your meatpacking plant, knowing that the town couldn't afford this because they had just, you know, farming had just gone the way of the dodo bird, you know, and the railroad had already gone out of business. If they lose meatpacking, they're really in trouble. So a company like IBP comes in and says publicly and openly and brazenly, we're going to close your meatpacking plant unless you agree to disband the union. Well, of course the people are going to agree to disband the union. I mean, what's their choice? But the second that the union is disbanded, then nobody has benefits anymore and wages drop by two-thirds.
And so they turn to meth to be able to work those second or third jobs that they need to find, or whatever overtime they can take in order to keep up some semblance of a standard of living. But is there more than that also? The nature of the drug is really to counter a kind of mental health stress epidemic in some ways. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, when meth was considered a miracle drug in the United States in the 1930s and 40s, and it was, you didn't need a prescription for it. It was widely available. One of the things, of the many ailments that it was used to treat, from erectile dysfunction to alcoholism, the chief one was depression, because it made people feel really good for a really long time. So if you're a guy who just lost your job, or, your father just lost his farm, and now your wages just got cut by two-thirds at the meatpacking plant, you know, I think it's not an unfair stretch to say that you've got big reasons to want to feel a little better about how poorly things are going. And meth is a cheap way to do that, that also, again, has this added effect of helping you to work the double shift. The third aspect of meth's, you know, sort of socio-economic and socio-cultural uniqueness and profound effect, I think, in the middle of the country, is that a fairly large number of these people who were suddenly working for much less just decided that they would go into the meth business. They'd just make it themselves and sell it to everybody else who was working at the meatpacking plant. So, you know, I mean, it's this kind of triple whammy.
So it's this intersection of self-medication, needing to work more, and the need for some more income.
Exactly.
Now, Nick Redding, you tell this story, Methland, through the lives of a number of different characters. When I say characters, these are, of course, real people who kind of embody a lot of the difficulties and contradictions, the sorrows, the anguish of what they're seeing their town go through. So give us some thumbnail sketches of them. There's the doctor, Dr. Hallberg.
Right.
Nathan Leon, the county prosecutor, and Lori Arnold, who's a sister of Tom Arnold. as well. And why don't you start with those three?
Okay. And so the idea was, you know, to follow 4 years in the life of this town and then 4 years in the life of these people. And but I think the further idea was, you know, to not approach this as a drug epidemic just seen from the view of the addicts, but also the, you know, in painting a portrait of this place, to try and do portraits of the people who are sort of affected collaterally, I guess, if you will. And in that way, I think Dr. Hallberg is probably, you know, maybe the best example, because he's the town doctor. He's the town general practitioner in this kind of old school way. His father was the town GP before him, and he left to go to medical school and could have, you know, gone anywhere from there, and decided that he would come home to kind of take over the mantle from his father. And by 2003, instead of having the just the, you know, used to be that broken bones and cancer and childbirth were, you know, sort of the three principal things that he might have dealt with. And by 2003, 95% of all of his patients were seeing him for something related to methamphetamine. That doesn't mean they were all addicts. It might be depression because their child was an addict, or it might be you know, in the case of one of the other people in the book, the fact that he blew himself up in a lab fire and obviously needed a doctor.
And tell us what happened to him. I mean, just parenthetically here.
Well, parenthetically, the this guy, his name is Roland Jarvis, and he's the sort of addict that, in the book, and a former meatpacking worker who made his own meth and blew up his lab and suffered third-degree burns over 78% of his body, and burned his nose and his fingers off, and somehow survived. And then the first thing he did when he got out of the hospital after 3 months was to get high on meth again.
Yeah. So Dr. Owine, he's seeing these patients now, 95% of whom are in some way coming to him because of the meth epidemic. What does that do to him?
Well, you know, I think that it's, you know, sort of back to your earlier point of, you know, on a community-wide scale, there's this depression, you know, there's this sense that things have gone terribly wrong, and how are we going to fix them, and can we fix them? And, you know, if you're the doctor, I mean, you are the town doctor, and this is what you see every day. The toll that it took on Clay was terrible, and in fact, it only fueled the fire of his own increasing alcoholism. That was essentially how Clay dealt with it for a long time.
Right. And then there was the county prosecutor. Tell us
about
him.
So Nathan Leon is the assistant Fayette County prosecutor, and his story is not really that dissimilar to Clay Hallberg's, insofar as Nathan is a generation younger, but he grew up on a farm 12 miles outside of town, and left Iowa to go to law school, and then decided to come home because he, like Clay, wanted to try and have some sort of positive effect on his increasingly beleaguered hometown. And so the, you know, the part that he played was, he was essentially hired by the mayor of the town, or given the job by the mayor of the town, with the idea that he was going to help to clean up small lab meth production, which, again, this is back in 2002. So, and at that point, it had just gotten out of control.
Yeah, and then there's the meth dealer, the sister of Tom Arnold, Lori Arnold. She becomes Well, she's both an addict, but she also becomes quite the businesswoman. And her story kind of is indicative of the trajectory in some ways that the production of meth took in this country.
Right. And so unlike a small-time meth cook, again, who might be making meth for his friends who are working at the meatpacking plant, Lori was just a much bigger thinker and a much more accomplished business person, really. And she decided that instead of getting involved on a small scale, she was going to go right to the source, which at the time meant to California, which is where all the industrial meth production was happening. And by industrial, I mean large quantities of meth. She essentially connected Iowa to the California meth trade, which at the time was just kind of coming online. And she very quickly became not only the biggest meth dealer in Iowa, but arguably in the Midwest.
And yet she started out as a waitress, right?
She was a bartender. She dropped out of high school after 10th grade. I mean, that was it for her education. And she'd never done meth until one day her brother-in-law stopped by and gave her a couple lines, and she went out to the bar that night and sold a little bit. And within 6 months, she had basically connected this town to the meth pipeline in California and was bringing hundreds and hundreds of pounds to Iowa.
And making a whole lot of money in the process.
Yeah.
This is another place where your story, where your book, Methland, Nick Redding, where it really kind of shines a lens on the much larger story that surrounds this story of meth. And that's where you bring in Big Pharma. There was a time, you talk about, and there was a man, Gene Haslip, who might have been able to actually stop the meth epidemic in its tracks. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, he had the idea. This was a guy who had almost single-handedly stopped the Quaalude epidemic, which I remember was getting underway when I was in college. Briefly tell us about him and then what he wanted to do and why he couldn't do it.
So Gene Haslip worked for DEA, and his job was essentially, he worked for the arm of the administration that tries to decide what drugs are going to be monitored in some way, the importation of them. So the basic ingredient that is necessary to make methamphetamine is pseudoephedrine. And pseudoephedrine is the reason that the cold medicine Sudafed is called Sudafed. Almost all the cold medicine in the world is made from pseudoephedrine. This is another thing that makes meth unique, because there's no crop that has to be grown. It's an entirely synthetic drug, but its basic building block is also the basic building block of arguably the most, and certainly one of the most lucrative licit drug businesses in the world, that being cold medicine. So what Gene Haslip said all the way back in 1986 was, we're going to have a problem with methamphetamine. It's already starting out in California. People are starting to produce large quantities because they can have access to pseudoephedrine. And so we need to simply monitor the importation of pseudoephedrine, and we need to figure out who it's going to make sure that it's really going to a drug company and not a industrial methamphetamine manufacturer. And beginning then and for the rest of his 15-year career, thanks to the drug lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, he was never even able to get even the most basic form of, or effective form of pseudoephedrine importation monitoring.
What you're basically saying is that, you know, this one drug is critical. It's not grown, it's only made. So
right.
There are, in fact, I think there are only 9 factories worldwide that actually make this.
Right.
And he was saying that if you just simply institute some kind of tracking mechanism, that you would be able to stop it from going to illegal manufacturing, just like had happened with Quaaludes. I guess it was there was a certain ingredient, and they were able to institute this, and all of a sudden, the bad guys couldn't get it.
Right. That's essentially it. So on one level, I think it's certainly galling that even just a simple means of monitoring was not acceptable to the pharmaceutical companies. But what's even more galling is that dating back 20 years, pharmaceutical companies have been able to make cold medicine. It's just as effective as that which is made with pseudoephedrine from something that you can't make meth out of. And the other thing that Hayslip was trying to do was trying to get them to make cold medicine out of something you can't make methamphetamine out of. They had an already FDA-approved drug that had proven to be very effective as a cold medicine precursor, and they simply refused to make cold medicine out of it.
And why?
I don't really know, honestly. I think that would be a wonderful question for a congressional panel to ask these people. I really don't know. I think that it's more than stands to reason that since there are only 9 plants on the or factories in the world that produce these drugs from which to make cold medicine, that if all the American pharmaceutical companies decided tomorrow that they're not going to make cold medicine from pseudoephedrine, they're going to make it from phenylephrine, those 9 plants would immediately start producing the phenyl. I mean, so, you know, to say that they wouldn't be able to get it, that's not a viable argument. I have no idea.
And just so our listeners understand the stakes, you describe in the book, you say that this is a social cancer, basically. What does methamphetamine mean to a community like All Wine? What does it do to the community, and what does it do to the people? What does it do to the kids and the families?
That line I got from Clay Hallberg, and he said it was a sociocultural cancer, and what he means by that on a community basis, but also on a national basis, is that you don't have to be the meth addict in order for this to ruin your life. You can be the mother of the meth addict. You can be the doctor who sees that 9 out of 10 of all of his cases are related to meth. You can be the prosecutor who sees that 90% of all of his child abuse cases and all of his cases are all related to methamphetamine. And you add that to the fact that it's an incredible sap on whatever revenue strength you have left, because it costs so much money to clean up labs, it costs so much money to incarcerate people and to try people and to try and help people when they are addicted, and it costs so much money with the amount of stealing that goes on as a result of something like a widespread methamphetamine addiction. So in Clay's wording, what he meant is that this drug sort of metastasizes into every corner of the community and into people's sort of psychic awareness of their self-value and of the value of their community. And essentially it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the more people that feel puny about everything, the more that the people do meth. And because that's the only thing that's going to make you feel good, or it's the only thing that's going to let you make money. So it just becomes this really brutal circle.
And what happens, I mean, why... What is destroying the families?
Well, I mean, the reason that, you know, child abuse goes up is because once you stop feeling good on meth and you come down, then you feel really, really horrible. And you also sleep for several days at a time, and nobody takes care of your children. And the result is a lot of these sort of stunningly horrifying thing, you know, children that are just sort of left to fend for themselves, or babies that don't get taken out of cribs for days at a time, and babies that don't get fed. I mean, the cases are pretty revolting, actually. But the other thing in terms of children is that you know, once there's this, once two or three generations have become addicted to this drug and have become sort of inured to the fact that things don't seem to be getting better and may not, then that becomes a part of their children's lives and their children's children's lives, and this is just the way it is, and it becomes ever harder to turn things around.
So basically, you've come from, you know, even though perhaps the whole idea of small town middle America was never quite the way the ideal picture of it was, still, you went from healthy communities, fairly healthy families, farm families, you're saying now, to an initiation of a cycle of generational abuse.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Now, you got some criticism of your book, because there were people who said to you, and I'd also heard it before, that the meth epidemic is way overblown. Mm-hmm. How do you answer that criticism?
Well, in a couple of ways. I mean, one of them is that for the most part, I never saw any of those people in any of the towns that I was in. So I really think until you go and spend 4 years looking at this, it's difficult to sort of pick the facts out from the hyperbole and from the exaggeration. And but one of the things that's in the book is that when we talk about a drug epidemic, it's a little bit of a misnomer, because if you actually ask a drug epidemiologist, and I asked a number of them, what is a drug epidemic? How many people out of 10 have to be addicted in order for it to be an epidemic? There's no answer to that.
And what does what said to you, this is a drug epidemic? This is something that is not just an all wine, but something that everybody really needs to pay some attention to?
That's a great question. The number one, it was the pervasiveness of the actual drug. The ease with which I was able to know immediately in any town I went to where I could get it, from whom I could get it, the ease with which I could see burned down houses. I could see people who were obviously high all over the place. I mean, once you're sort of accustomed to what you're looking at, it becomes fairly obvious. So the pervasiveness is certainly one aspect. I think the other aspect of it is again, if we go back to the idea that, you know, meth of its own accord is a bad thing, and it has all kinds of horrible effects, from economic to social and cultural, but it's really just a symptom of a larger issue, and that issue is an economic one. So when all of the criticism of the meth epidemic was going on, and people were saying, well, it's been overblown, what I was saying was, you're missing the point. Like, you have really just missed a great opportunity, thanks to meth and by using meth as a lens, to see what the larger issue is. And the larger issue is that the middle of the country, the middle of the United States, is a very poor place. And there are reasons for it. And there are, frankly, a lot of them should never have come about in the first place. You know, because of the link to big pharma, because of the link to big agriculture, which is a historical case study in how companies and government can be unethical and immoral.
Well, Nick Redding, thanks so much for talking with us here at Writer's Voice. Your book is Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. It's really a gripping story. I read it actually in one sitting because I couldn't put it down.
Wow.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for saying that. That makes me feel good. And it's really been a pleasure.
Nick Redding is also author of The Last Cowboys at the End of the World, The Story of the Gauchos of Patagonia. Listeners, what do you think of the meth epidemic? Do you have a personal experience about it to share? Join the conversation at writersvoice.net or writersvoice, all one word, on Twitter. Next up, we talk about a fateful day in the life of Henry David Thoreau. Stay tuned. ¶¶ Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One fine April day in 1844, Henry David Thoreau was on an outing with a friend. They caught some fish, and Thoreau lit a match to start a cook fire. The woods were dry, the fire spread, and by day's end, 300 acres of woodland had been destroyed. This fire lies at the center of John Pipkin's novel, Woodsburner. The book's action takes place over the course of that day, and along the way, the reader meets an amazing cast of characters whose lives are forever changed by the fire Thoreau set. As was Thoreau's. Only 26, his life was at a crossroads. He was working in the family pencil-making business. He tried his hand at being a tutor, a teacher, and a published writer. And he hadn't yet had much success at all.
And right around this time, the one journal that had been regularly publishing, or with some regularity publishing his work, was the Transcendentalist Journal, The Dial, and that journal had just closed its doors. So early in the spring of 1844, you can sort of see Thoreau as someone whose career as a writer is at a standstill, his career as a teacher is at a standstill. Even as an environmentalist, he's already talked about going off to live alone somewhere, you know, possibly a Walden Pond or somewhere out in the wilderness. But he hasn't done that yet either. And when he returns from New York to Concord late in 1843, he once again begins living with his family and begins working in his father's pencil-making factory, which few people realize that the Thoreaus were pencil makers. And in fact, Thoreau pencils are regarded as some of the best pencils in America. So in the spring of 1844, Henry David Thoreau is essentially a pencil maker and is making a variety of innovations to the business. He's perfecting some of the machines that were used for making pencils, and it's at this time that he decides to take a trip on the river with his friend as a break from his job, and that's when the fire starts.
And you write that he, plagued by indecision, he defines his life by what it is not.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he seemed to be someone who had a great deal of potential, you know, that potential that he saw in himself and that his friends saw in himself, but he hadn't yet fulfilled any of that potential. So people like Ralph Waldo Emerson could see the potential in Thoreau as a great thinker and a great writer, but that's not something that he's actually become yet. William Ellery Channing actually is the person who encourages him in the following months to go live at Walden Pond. And he, again, was one of those people who saw in Thoreau the potential of being a great thinker or philosopher, but he's not become that yet. So I think this was a point in his life where, you know, even Thoreau himself was growing frustrated with the fact that he had these ambitions and he had these talents, but he hadn't been able to actually accomplish anything yet.
And then this terrible fire happens. Tell us a little bit about the landscape that was around him at this time. And as I understand, it was a fairly deforested landscape to begin with. So would these woods then have been, you know, very special to the people, to the inhabitants there?
They were very special, although they were not in any way protected. All of the land that burned was privately owned, and in fact, all of the land around the neighboring Walden Pond was also privately owned. And Thoreau and Emerson and others had talked about the possibility, particularly Emerson, had talked about the possibility of going and buying some land at Walden Pond to be able to preserve it, because there were no rules or guidelines in place for how the land could be used or how to protect it. And there was a growing concern that people were just going out and cutting down trees for their private use, and no one's really looking out for the landscape. And at this time, again, I think few people today realize that there are actually more trees at Walden Pond today than there were at Thoreau's time, because Concord and that area was beginning to suffer from deforestation because of the growth of agriculture. Concord itself was a bustling trade town. Concord was growing. You know, people were cutting down the trees for lumber. So there was a growing concern that the forests in the area were beginning to disappear. But again, even on this front, no one was really doing anything yet to try to protect that land. And the loss of the woods that burn because of Thoreau's fire was a private loss. I mean, the individual owners who owned that land were, you know, lost the value of their property. But this does, it's only a couple of months after this that Emerson goes out and finally buys a piece of land at Walden Pond to save it from the woodsman's axe. So I think, to a certain extent, we might even look at this fire as a motivation for Emerson to go and do something that he had long been planning to do.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, and as you say, I mean, Concord was a bustling trade town,
right,
but it also was home to some of the greatest philosophers, including Ralph Waldo Emerson, that our country has ever had.
Yes.
What was their idea about the wilderness? What was their idea about nature? This was, of course, a group that Thoreau was part of.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, for the transcendentalists, you know, the natural world really represented, a passage or a gateway to the spiritual world. And Emerson saw in nature a kind of spirit and unity that corresponded to the spiritual world. So for them, of course, this would also be a sacred place worthy of their protection.
So what do you put yourself in the mind of Thoreau? He's done this terrible fire. We should tell our listeners, well, first of all, we're talking with John Pipkin. His novel is Woods Burner. What were his feelings? You say he never really mentioned this in his journals. How did you find out about it? And how did you imagine his feelings about it, or were you able to actually discover them?
Well, Thoreau writes very little about the fire at the time it happens. He is, you know, by 1844, he is already keeping his famous journals. But there's a large gap in his journals for the years 1843 to 1844, which in some way I think we could see as indicative of the kind of creative malaise he had fallen into at this time. So at the time of the fire, there is no entry in his journal describing that fire, and it's not until 6 years later, in 1850, that Thoreau has a fairly long and detailed description of how the fire started and what happened and how it spread. And that there's one point during the fire when he's waiting for help to arrive that he actually climbs to the top of Fairhaven Hill and very Nero-like sort of sits at the top of the hill and watches the woods burn as he's waiting for help to arrive. But it's an interesting passage that he writes, because in sort of typical Thoreau fashion, you can see him struggling with his own guilt over having caused the event, and at the same time becoming very defensive toward anyone who might accuse him of having actually done something wrong. So he begins by talking about how he felt shameful and guilty for having brought this destruction upon the natural world. And then he stops and says, but the fire was a glorious spectacle, and he was the only one there to enjoy it, and that, you know, fire itself is but part of the natural world and was only eating its natural food. So he really hadn't done anything unnatural. What he had done was unleash a force of nature upon nature itself. And so then he sort of turns his defense against people who would accuse him of having deprived the landowners who privately owned the woods, having in essence robbed them of the woodlands. And of course he says that, you know, no man has a right to own the land, and so therefore he's committed no wrong against anyone. So it's a very interesting passage for trying to sort through Thoreau's mind and the struggle he was having with himself over, you know, over what he had done, whether he should feel guilty or responsible, or whether the people who were, you know, accusing him of having, you know, stolen from others by doing this, whether they were correct. But the way that the way that I found out about it was actually not through Thoreau's journals, but was through a line in Harper's Magazine in 2003. It was I think the July issue of Harper's, and the Harper's Index listed, there was a little factoid that it said, you know, 300, the number of acres burned down by Henry David Thoreau in 1844, and that just sparked my interest, and that's at that point I began doing the research into this.
And other than his journal, what sources did you find?
Well, from the actual period, there is a newspaper article in the Concord Freeman of May 2nd, 1844, and that that article documents the fire and what was destroyed. And it's interesting that that article already, you know, 160 years ago, that article already takes the line of argument that this should be a lesson to anyone in the future who would go to the woods for recreation, that they need to be careful and take care, and that this is an example of, you know, what can happen through acts of carelessness, how people who are coming to the woods for recreation can accidentally destroy nature. There was one reminiscence of the fire from a woman in the late 1800s who was interviewed about her memories of Concord in the early 19th century, and she recalls how, as a young girl, the people of Concord were angry at Thoreau for having done this and called him Woodsburner behind his back for years to come. And that's where, of course, the title of the novel, Woodsburner, comes from, is this recollection. But beyond that, there's not a great deal that's been written about it.
I'd like to turn to the novel now. We've been talking about the history, and we're talking with John Pipkin. This is your first published novel, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Woodsburner. It's a wonderful exploration, one day in the life of Concord, of Henry David Thoreau, after Thoreau accidentally starts a fire that burns a section of woods in Concord. You have some incredible characters in this book. They are wonderful. They are strange. I wondered of the imagination that gave birth to them, as a matter of fact. One of them is Odmund Huss. They're two elderly lesbians from Romania. There's an evangelical preacher who's also a drug addict. And then there's Elliot Calvert, who is a playwright and a bookseller who also sells pornography. First of all, tell us a little about Odmund Huss. I think he's really, in many ways, the most compelling character other than Henry David Thoreau.
Odmund, like the other characters of the book outside of Henry David Thoreau, are fictional characters. They're not based on historical figures, and they're not composites of historical figures. They're just completely fictional. And what I was hoping to be able to do in with Odmund and with the other characters as well was try to give a sense of America in the 1840s. One of the things beyond Thoreau's life being at a crossroads, one of the things that I found intriguing about the period is that America itself seemed to be historically at a crossroads in its own cultural identity. The Revolutionary War is beginning to fade into the past this time, and there are just the first flickers of the Civil War that might be looming on the horizon. But in the 1840s, there's still this sense of what is America and what is this grand experiment and where are we going? And of course, it's around this time, I think, I can't remember now, 1837, 1839, when Ralph Waldo Emerson delivers his American Scholar address and actually tells people it's time for America to begin creating a literature of its own and a philosophy of its own and an art of its own, and it's time for us, in other words, to begin developing our own culture. So I was trying to imagine what it would be like to be alive at that time in a country that in and of itself is looking for its own sense of nationhood and its own sense of cultural identity. And to that extent, Odmund Huss represents the immigrant experience in America at this time, what it would be like to completely relocate to a different country.
But he does also represent much more than that. I mean,
he's
a tragic figure in some ways, at least, you know, his beginnings. He comes to this country and as a child. And loses his family on shore as he's coming in. He's a very intense character. So talk a little bit about him and how you conceived him.
Well, I was trying to think of again what it would be like to come to a country and start your life all over again as a child, completely divorced, not only from your homeland, but from the only family you'd ever known. And also what it would be like to be doing that in a country where you have no, you know, there's all this great potential and all this great promise, but of course there's no roadmap to follow. There are no directions to follow. You have to reinvent your life on your own. And we're so used to the story of the American pioneer who goes out and, you know, has a vision of what he or she wants to accomplish, and they go right out and they, you know, realize their vision. And I was wondering what it was like to be, say, the opposite, an ordinary person who is just trying to figure out how to live their life in the best way that they can, but is leading the kind of life that Thoreau made famous with the phrase, a life of quiet desperation, where he's someone who, you know, has ambitions and has desires, but is really too timid and too insecure, perhaps, to go out and realize them, and so really feels a sense of alienation in this new world where he sees promise all around them, and he of course feels the promise of his own desires, but feels so alienated and such an outsider in this world that he has to keep those desires and wants to himself, and just sort of look at this world of plenty and not know how to act, how to go out and take advantage of it.
And then there's a character very different from him, Elliot Calvert. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who thinks, you know, he wants to make it. He's got a
right.
very intense ambition. And he goes through a kind of transformation in the book. Could you talk a little bit about him, too?
Elliot Calvert, I was trying to deal with the sort of age-old idea of art versus commerce, and you know how someone at this point in time would attempt to realize their artistic vision while at the same time trying to make a living, trying to find a way to make it in the world, to become a success in the world, and he like Odman is someone who's also leading a life of quiet desperation. You know, he's pursuing success in one form or another, and in some ways I think is thwarted by his own achievement of material success as he feels his ambitions in the artistic world sort of slipping through his fingers. These two worlds, for Elliot at least, are at odds with one another, and he wants to believe that he is someone who is somehow above material success and material desires, but in the end, he's really not, and he is his own worst enemy in that sense.
And through the fire, he becomes kind of a deeper character.
Yeah, I think all of the characters through their encounter with the flames are somehow changed, maybe some for the better, maybe some for the worse. That in each case, these characters all lack some catalyst. They're all in need of some catalyst or some motivation to push them forward and to take the chances they need to take to reinvent themselves, to become the people that they envision themselves becoming. And all of them we meet at a point in their lives where they're stagnant and unable to make that, to take those risks, to experiment and reinvent themselves. And in some cases, the fire becomes the catalyst or the spark that moves them forward. And in some cases, I think some of the characters are actually frightened by the idea of this potential, or frightened by the idea of freedom to a certain extent, and are actually driven in the opposite direction.
Hmm. And the two elderly women, was it Romania they were from?
Oh, they're from Moravia, yes.
Moravia, yeah. Where did they come from?
You know, I wanted to try to get at other realms of the American experience at this time. And, you know, for Anezka and Zelenka, I really wanted to, again, include an example of another pair of outsiders, people who were outside the mainstream in the old world, in the old country, and come to America because America offers them the promise of acceptance, and again, the promise of being able to somehow reinvent themselves. And so in that case, they are yet another piece of the American dream to a certain extent. That as America itself is trying to figure out what it's all about, there are people from around the world looking at America and seeing the potential, but for each of them, it represents something different. And for Nezka and Zelenka, it represents the freedom of anonymity, of being able to just come and live their lives the way they want.
And then there is the preacher Caleb Doughty, who, you know, is kind of the other side of the American religious experience, a very fierce character. Talk about him and his obsessions.
Right. Well, Caleb Doughty, to a certain extent, I think, represents that the strain of religious dogma in America, and this ongoing sense that it is already present in the 1840s, I think, that somewhere America has gone wrong. I think we're used to hearing this in the late 20th century, even perhaps the early 21st century now, that things used to be better, that there was this golden age when everything was better than it is now. And you're already seeing a sense of that, especially in some religious communities in the 1840s, that America, particularly in New England and in Boston, Boston was meant to be this shining city on the hill, and somehow it's already gone wrong. I mean, we're only, 60, 70 years into American history, and already everything has fallen apart. So Caleb Doughty is someone who, instead of, say, the transcendentalists who are looking at the changing world and looking at new ways of thinking about human relationships and the way people relate, not only with each other, but relate to the world. Doughty is someone who's very steeped in dogma and wants to return to the old ways, to the language of the Great Awakening, and to a more rigorous and dogmatic approach to spirituality. And so through Doughty's character, I was trying to get at that line of thinking that I think survives up until this day.
I want to ask you, since this was your first book, what was maybe the greatest lesson for you as a writer in writing it?
Probably the single greatest lesson, and it's probably a disappointingly simple one too, is that regardless of what the time period is, or the historical details or information that a writer might be dealing with, the most important aspect of a novel is its characters. That it is still the individual characters who drive the story. Their relationships with each other are what is central to the cohesiveness of the novel, and not just the history or the historical details or the factual information that might be interesting or provide the fodder for curious and engaging anecdotes. It all comes down to, in the final analysis, it all comes down to having characters who, are alive enough that people in any setting can in some way relate to them, whether it's now or tomorrow, or whether these characters are set 150 years ago, that there's still something in them that speaks to a contemporary reader, and that we care about them and care about what happens to them and what their hopes and dreams and ambitions are.
Well, John Pipkin, thanks so much for talking with us. Your book is Woods Burner. It's a wonderful novel, and it's about Thoreau and many other wonderful characters as well.
Well, thank you, Francesca. I've enjoyed this.
John Pipkin writes in Austin, Texas. He's taught writing and literature at St. Louis University, Boston University, and elsewhere. To get answers to frequently asked questions about Henry David Thoreau, including about the fire, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.